Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. All right. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Tell us what's on tap this week.
Okay. We have a great set of questions on exceptions to rules, judgments of men versus women for sexual relationships with minors, ideological consistency, and more.
Yeah, it should be a very good show. I have, like, back to the point where I have way, way too many notes. So, like, woohoo, excited about that. I'm ready to go. If you're listening live, you can post questions and comments. That's over in the text chat at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Okay, what's been going on this week?
So I announced earlier this week on Facebook and actually on my blog, too, that Paul and I are definitely headed for divorce, but for logistical reasons, it's very amicable. Everything is good. But for logistical reasons, we are not going to initiate the legal process for a little while, for a couple months. Now, when that happens, I'm going back to my maiden name. So my name will become Diana Brickell, legally. That's B-R-I-C-K-E-L-L. It's not pronounced Brickell. So again, you have like another name that doesn't, you know, people don't know how to pronounce it. Well, this one's a little bit easier. So I'm going to be going back to that. But what I did when I made that announcement was I changed my name on Facebook to Diana Brickell again. And, you know, I was just like, okay, that's all I'll do for now. But the moment I did it, I was like, no, I want everything to be changed. So I'm actually working on basically changing my social identity now. My Twitter handle is Diana Brickell, although I reserved Diana Shea. I created a new account for that just so that replies and so on would actually go somewhere. And
that's a good thing Brickell's not that common, otherwise you would have no hope of pulling this off.
Yeah, I don't know that there's any, I don't think there's any other Diana Brickells. There's, like, I got dianabrickell@gmail.com, right?
That's crazy.
So, yeah, that's crazy sauce. So, whereas there are other Diana Shays, because it's a, you know, it's Shea is a very, very common Asian last name, and Diana is apparently not all that uncommon as a first, you know, Americanized or whatever it is, first name. Anyway, so... yeah, so I'm super happy about that. Basically, I'm not going to have too much trouble on that score. So we will be updating the show's intro. I'm going to be updating the website, doing all of that kind of stuff. Obviously, legally, I'm still Diana Shea. I have no idea how it's going to work with my bank in terms of cashing checks and so on. I'll worry about that later. But for now, obviously, like, legally, I'm still Diana Shea. Socially, I'm Diana Brickell, but I'm not going to be angry or anything if you screw up, because even I have been accidentally, you know, like, even it's not fully automatized in my own brain yet. So no worries about that. I will respond to you.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
I do cringe every time the theme goes by now, though, because it's for the show. It's like, oh, really,
yeah.
I'm saying
it
wrong now.
Yeah. You'll have to re-record that for me, Greg.
Got to re-record that. All right. Well, anything else?
No, I think that's about it. I've been busy doing all kinds of stuff. So, but I'm super excited about the show. I'm feeling actually reinvigorated about the show for various reasons. So anyway, I'm super excited about that, and that's why I have way too many notes for the first time in a little while. So hooray for that! Get
awesome.
Ready for the fire hose here, folks.
Okay, let's hit it. Exceptions to rules. When should exceptions to established rules be granted? People often oppose some proposed exception to the rules on the grounds that doing so would set a dangerous precedent and engender abuse. For example, suppose that an honest and diligent student is in the hospital and he wants to keep up with his schoolwork as much as possible. His parents propose that he take his math exam from the hospital and they'll monitor him during the exam. And the school refuses on the grounds that if all students were allowed to do that, then cheating would be rampant because not all parents would be honest or diligent monitors. Is that a valid reason for refusing this proposed exception to the rules? When should exceptions be granted to established rules?
Yeah, this is a good question. There's, I think, a lot to be said about this, and I'm just going to try to give a 10,000 foot overview, and we'll see how that goes, and feel free to submit follow-up questions. So the bad news is for my rule-loving listeners, those of you who are really, really sticklers for the rule, which is that, A, not all rules should be adhered to, and there's, in fact, no single rule for dealing when it's okay to break rules. Right, or when it's okay to franchise.
Oh, this is going to be a serious problem for Tammy.
I know. So much here, it really depends on the particular context. There's lots and lots of judgment calls to be made. And the goal, I think, is to have that done with due concern for the relevant facts and with the relevant context. And, Greg, you had some just initial thoughts about this that I thought were
worth. Yeah, and just right off the bat, I was thinking what matters here is context. If you're playing a pro golf game or you're in the Super Bowl, then the rules are there for a reason, and it's really important that everybody follow the damn rules.
Deflategate.
What's that?
Deflategate.
Yeah, Deflategate. There you go. But in everyday, well, in pro golf, man, they're practically lawyers out there. Every little jot and tittle in the rule book. But in everyday matters, you can just look at the context and the purpose of the rules. So in this case, you could see in the question that they were going to the purpose of not allowing that, which was to cut down on cheating. Now, whether their reasoning was correct or not is another matter, but you can see what they're trying to do.
Right. Yeah, and that's the question. So here we have this rule in place to prevent cheating. Is this really necessary? That's what they're going to have to ask. And we'll talk about that particular example later, because I think they could, depending on the context, they could go either way. So it's actually a good example.
Yeah.
And the purpose of the rules, that's going to really, really matter here. Like, what is it? What's the goal that we are trying to achieve? And are we actually achieving that by sticking to the rule, or can we actually better achieve the goal or achieve some other purpose by abandoning the rule?
Yeah. Usually there's the direct purpose, and then there's also some meta purposes, like not making things too complicated with exceptions and so on. But
right.
We'll probably get into all that. So another thought was that for some of us, not everyone, we differentiate between rules and principles. In my case, I conceive of principles as things that do not have exceptions. They're general truths, and you can't have an exception to, say, the truth of how addition works, say, and you wouldn't have I wouldn't allow exceptions to other principles. But rules, on the other hand, rules I will allow exceptions to. And let's see, did you want to go into why?
Yeah, I've got some. Well, I actually don't think that I don't think that distinction quite gets what you want. Or rather, I have a different view about the relationship between rules and principles here. So
I don't know. We might agree on this.
Oh, I'm sure we agree ultimately, but I'm going to make my case and then you can tell me whether you agree.
Okay.
Because it was only actually I was chatting with Andrew and Arthur about the questions, and it was only in talking to them and Arthur making this argument about the difference between rules and principles. So I was like, no, like, wait a minute, I think there's something else quite going on here. So the point that I would want to say is, I mean, look, a principle could be something like care for your dental health. You know, this is something that should be important. Make sure that you take the time to care for this. But a rule would be something like floss every single day. But sometimes, like, look, maybe you haven't slept in 36 hours, and it really doesn't matter if you freaking floss and brush your teeth that night. You just, like, you need to go to bed right now. And so, like, on the one hand, the principle is still valid. You should care for your dental health. But, you know, sleep matters actually, like, way more at this particular point. So you can say to hell with the rule. So that kind of stuff does happen. But I do think it's really important to not have rules and principles be something really separate. The whole part of the point here is that rules should line up with and reflect your goals and your principles. Rules should be, in fact, concrete expressions of your principles and your goals. In other words, rules are ways that you achieve your goals. They're ways that you make sure that you are actually heading towards your goals. You have some rules, and okay, these are the things I'm going to follow, because if I do these things, I know that this is going to be helpful for achieving my goals. And there are also ways in which you implement your principles as well. And so I think oftentimes the way it actually works is that if breaking a rule is justified, that's because you're sort of outside the normal context in some way of the principle. In other words, the relevant principle or the relevant goal doesn't actually apply. So the relevant principle doesn't apply, or the goal actually isn't served by acting on the rule. So you this is like, you want to make sure that you're not thinking of principles and rules as something really separate, and well, one has exceptions and the other don't. No, what you need to do is when you're looking at rules and potentially breaking rules, is to say, look, what are the principles, the relevant principles here? What are the relevant, what are the goals that I have? And does this rule actually serve those at this particular point? Or am I outside of the usual context for rules, principles, and goals? So just for example, it's generally a rule that there's actually a particular way that if you're putting a blanket on a horse, you buckle things in a various order. And the reason that you do this is because if the horse bolts forward or you know, runs away from you in some fashion, you want the blanket to either fall off easily or stay on, one of the two. So you buckle the front and then you buckle the surcingles that are underneath. You don't want the horse to get caught in the blanket, and because then they'll like run through a fence and do something stupid, and then you have a vet bill, right? I have Lila, and Lila is super duper phlegmatic and not really prone to running around without due cause. And so it's just no big deal, however I buckle the blanket on her. Now, I tend to pay attention to this, right? If I'm blanketing and she's just out sort of free, I will blanket her in the standard, safest possible way, because it's more likely that she will do something stupid. If she's in her stall, yeah, whatever, right? We're totally fine. I could put it on upside down and it wouldn't be an issue. So whereas other horses, no matter where we are, I don't care if I've got them on a halter, I don't, you know, whatever it is, I'm definitely blanketing them in the safest possible way because I know their personality. So these are the kinds of things that you're gonna consider, the kind of context that will be relevant here, I think, in some cases. And lots of other kinds of contexts are relevant in other kinds of cases.
Yeah. So I totally agree. When I'm saying they're separate, I'm saying they're separate in the same sense that I consider concretes and abstractions separate. But
right.
The abstractions are the way to grasp and deal with the concretes.
Right.
And here I have a general principle, and the rules are concrete implementations of them or guidelines. It's the way I can work my way through, actually, like you were saying, head towards my goals without having to do an awful lot of work.
Yeah, without having to think about them every single time.
Yeah.
That's one of the benefits of a rule or having a habit. I think rules are sometimes the same.
Yeah.
They're in the same vein. Is I don't have to decide every single time, here's how I'm going to do this. No, I just have this rule. I'm flossing my teeth before I go to bed.
Yeah, and actually that's the implementation of principles in how my psychoepistemology rolls. There are rules, and I have rules for when the rules aren't valid, and tell the truth. That's the basic rule. Don't tell the truth if you're being coerced. It doesn't apply. So I even have rules for telling you when the rules won't apply. But ultimately, if I'm in a fuzzy area, I fall back to, okay, now I have to give consideration to what's my principle, what am I trying to do? And that's when I have to do work. It's a lot more work then.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, no, totally agree.
Okay. Awesome.
All right. So, do you have advice for rule makers?
Yeah. So, what I want to do is go through and give some advice for both rule makers and potential rule breakers, because this is sort of how to think about rules, how to either think about making the rules or deciding when to break them. Now, we're assuming that these are not just rules for yourself, although I guess a lot of what I say will be relevant in that case.
This will be interesting because Tammy is a total rule follower.
Yeah.
And it bothers her greatly to break a rule, so I'm watching her face during this discussion.
So I think that rule makers really need to be minimalist about it. Have as few rules as you possibly can and not one more. I also think it's really important to explain the reasons for your rules, identify the relevant goals and principles here, because that actually helps people, it makes people more inclined to respect them or to break them in a sensible way. So I remember back when I ran the O list, and I had this rule that you have to be an objectivist if you're going to be on the list, unless I allowed lurkers. So there was some lists allowed lurkers. And people would get really up in arms about this. Like, how could you? Like, this is cultish and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, dude, no, look, there's plenty of places if you just want to discuss a paleo diet. There's plenty of places to go do that. What we're trying to do is have a discussion about this topic from a similar philosophical background. And that basically, in my experience, we found that people who have this similar philosophical background, we have more productive discussions because we don't end up arguing about tangential stuff about, you know, government regulations or whatever it is. And so, like, it just makes for a more fruitful discussion. And I did this 20 bajillion times in various places. And almost every single time, the person would go, oh, all right, okay, like, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Explaining your reasons is really important. It helps people respect the rules.
Well, and it kind of goes along with it. If there's a rule with no reason, I dismiss it.
Yeah, and this is important. Like, rules can be really, really oppressive. Particularly those of you who love rules need to remember this. Particularly for lots of people who are not like you, rules are really, really oppressive. Particularly if there's a tangle of demands or there's, you know, just lots of verbiage. Like, you know, I need the TLDR version. I can't even read this whole thing and comprehend it. I just don't care enough. And what happens is, if there is this sort of tangle of demands, if there are lots and lots of rules, people will often throw up their hands and not even bother reading, and they'll just ignore all the rules, right? So the three rules that were actually really important that people know, that you really wanted people to follow, they're not even going to know what they are because they didn't bother to read it because you gave them too much, right? So that's one thing that can happen. Another thing that can happen is that if there's this tangle of rules, people will know, well, look, I'm always breaking some rules. And so they stop caring about that. They become desensitized. They don't care about the rule of law anymore in a way, right? They become desensitized to breaking the rules. Well, I'm just breaking this one more rule, so who gives a crap? And again, that can mean that they're breaking really important rules, not just the trivial ones. Oftentimes people are insulted, reasonably so, by being told the obvious, you know, like, do not touch the electrified wire, danger. You know, do not climb the fence with barbed wire and glass on top. You know, thanks, buddy. Screw you too. I'm not an idiot. And once people get this attitude that it's a kind of us versus them mentality, like, there's the rule makers which are trying to oppress me, oftentimes people start feeling justified in doing whatever they need to do to evade the rules. They'll look for loopholes. They'll get right to the edge. They'll do all kinds of things.
Yeah. They'll create patches of gray to play in.
Yeah.
Instead of embracing a rule that's good and saying, okay, this is going to help me.
Yeah. Yeah. I see why this property owner has this rule. They're like, let's see what I can get away with. The other problem is that sometimes rules are in fact too effective, meaning that people stop actually observing reality and they stop using their own judgment because, well, I'm just following the rules. And this happens a lot with government regulations, because what matters is not did you do the right thing, but did you follow the government regulation? And so people are like, well, look, I stamped all the forms. Like, what else do you want from me? How about using your brain, people? Yeah, so that's not good either. And I do think that there is this false sense of security that comes with the proliferation of rules. Like, movie theaters, after the Aurora shooting, lots more movie theaters put up no guns allowed signs. Dude, do you actually think that will stop? Adam Lanza's name?
Yeah, the offender probably knew that the people he was going to see in the theater would not want him there with his weapons.
Right. I mean, if he was willing to go to the theater and shoot people, do you think that he would not be willing to bring a firearm in the theater despite the rule?
Yeah.
So this is really important. There is this false sense of security. Well, look, we have the rule in place, therefore nobody will violate it. No. Don't think that. Sometimes more rules means that more people will be behaving badly. And this actually, there's been some interesting experiments in European cities lately where they've done away not just with all road signs, but even road markings of any kind. And the idea here is, look, we have all these signs, and what ends up happening psychologically is that people are pushing the boundaries all the time. They're trying to get away with as much as they can get away with. But maybe if we took away the signs, maybe what we would have is people starting to take responsibility for themselves and for their driving. Maybe they would start to actually really pay attention and notice what other drivers and other pedestrians and bicyclists and so on are doing. And what's interesting about this is that this really does seem to work. Accidents are hugely reduced by doing this. You know, people are driving slower. They're just paying more attention to everything around them because they're not thinking, well, the speed limit is 35, so, okay, I can go 40. So that seems to – that's a case for sometimes less rules mean more safety, which is something I wish Americans would learn.
A lot less clutter on the streets too.
Yeah.
I remember seeing some of those studies where they just – by putting in the right road features and getting rid of the false security, they had accidents drop, plummet.
Yes.
It's pretty cool. Yeah, roundabouts, KPON says. I remember the studies around roundabouts.
Yeah.
Okay. You have to pay attention.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, and I do think that there is a lesson in these experiments that more rules are not necessarily the means to creating this culture where everybody's behaving decently and sensibly, right? A lot of times rules are actually an impediment to creating that culture. And in fact, sometimes they can be a signal that people are expected to behave badly. And so that's in fact what people will do. So the other thing that I would add to rulemakers, there's two more things I want to add, is one, when people come asking for exceptions that are reasonable, go ahead and grant those, right? Don't get all uppity about, but we're setting a precedent and so on. No, you can grant case-by-case exceptions. You can say, look, we see in this context our purpose would be served better by breaking the rule rather than upholding it, so that's what we're going to do. And oftentimes what you need to do is explain those decisions so that people don't think, well, the rules don't mean anything, they're complete crap, blah, blah, blah. Like you have to be open. You have to be a little bit transparent about these kinds of things, particularly if you're in a position of authority, and that actually really, really helps people respect the rules that you do have, and people will respect your rules more if they know that you're going to be reasonable about it. So don't be too rule obsessed about that score. The other final comment that I would make for rulemakers is remember that whatever system you have in place, there are going to be people who will game the system, meaning there's going to be people who are trying to take advantage of every loophole. Like, no matter how nice you make it, no matter how friendly and comfortable and so on, and there are people who just have that mindset across the board. And when you confront them about it, you say, look, you're behaving in this, I know we have this system and it has these three rules, but you're behaving in an unreasonable way and you're causing problems for everybody else. And they will reply, well, I'm following the rules. And that's all they care about. Right?
Yeah, don't make me change them.
Yeah, and sometimes the only answer is either different rules or more strict rules, and oftentimes that harms everybody, which really sucks. It even harms the person who was trying to game the system. And
yeah, don't be the guy who messes it up for all of us.
Yeah, so A, don't be that guy. Like, really don't be that guy. But B, try to deal with that problem person, because the problem is not, are we have inadequate rules? The problem is you've got an asshole amongst you, and maybe you need to fire this person or make special rules for them or do something else. That's oftentimes better than inflicting more rules on everybody else. I mean, sometimes you can tweak the rules so that they do actually work, but not always. Not always.
Yeah. All right. So how about the potential rule breakers? Any guidance there?
Yeah. So beware of rule worship. This is obviously advice to both sides. Beware of being concerned with following rules for their own sake. And I think, I can't remember if I've mentioned this, but it's somebody who is high C, high conscientiousness in the DISC personality system, who is most likely to make that kind of error. So if you're high C, beware of this, beware of following rules for their own sake. So I think what you need to do is pay attention to the purpose of the rules. Ask yourself, what are the background principles at work here? What purpose does this rule serve? And does my following the rule in this particular case actually serve the purpose or frustrate it? And then what you need to do is pay attention to respecting the principle, respecting the purpose, even if you're breaking the rule. So in other words, try to focus a little bit more on the spirit of the rule, not the letter. And I would also give that same advice to the people who are gaming the system, right? Focus on the spirit of the rule and not just the letter.
Yeah.
I do think that if the rule is dumb, if it's outdated, or if it's too restrictive, or whatever it is, propose a revision to people. Don't just go around breaking them willy-nilly. I think oftentimes you can say, hey, look, boss, like, I know we have this rule about X, Y, and Z, but given that we're no longer on DOS machines, maybe we should do something a little bit different. Like, maybe we don't need 7-character file names all the time now. Boss.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, in my conversation with Andrew and Arthur, Andrew gave some advice, and I feel a little bit ambivalent about this. Like, I like it and I don't like it. So I'm gonna give it and let folks decide what they think. So he said basically, look, if you're breaking a rule and the rule is generally good, often it's better to do that breaking in a less visible way. Because if you do that, then other people, like, this is assuming you're justified in breaking the rule. But if you do that, other people who are in different circumstances who actually aren't justified in breaking the rule will not be inclined to disrespect the rule and break it kind of willy-nilly.
And, oh, wow.
So
a little thought here.
I like it in the sense that yes, like there's a way in which sometimes you want to do things in a bit quieter way because you don't want to give false impressions, right? But it also seems a bit like there's, sneaking, and it seems a bit like the
there's thumb. There's another answer to this, though, that addresses the same concern, and that is to make it clear that you're breaking the rule and why.
Yeah, but you can't always do that with everybody, right? Sometimes you can. And if you can do that, I think that's actually the better thing to do. But not, it's not always possible to do that. So anyway, I just think if you're going to do this, make sure that you're doing it because you don't want to give a false impression, not because you're hiding what you're doing. And in particular, one should be more willing to be open about it with the relevant authorities and say, look, I'm breaking this rule. Here's why. I'm not going to make a big to-do about it. I'll do it more quietly. But like, don't. If you're fearing that your boss might catch you, then that's a sign that you're being dishonest. Anyway, hopefully I have portrayed Andrew's view correctly there. If not, he can correct me. But yeah, I think that's it's interesting advice, and I think that's one has to apply that fairly carefully.
Okay, so then what do you think about the example of the student taking the exam from the hospital?
Yeah, so I think that the school could reasonably go either way. They could decide to allow the student to take the test or not. It would really depend on the particular circumstances. So let's say that the student could easily take the test or the exam later. The parents, I'm missing a not in that sentence. Imagine that the student cannot easily take the exam later. The parents are well known, they're known to be reliable, they're known to be really good, honest people, and the student is also known to be a good, reliable, honest student, never been in trouble, et cetera, et cetera. Then I think it would be reasonable to say, look, sure, we're going to allow you to take the exam in the hospital. Or another thing to do is say, look, we're going to monitor you on Skype, right? Like that would be reasonable. But if it's not the case, I mean, let's say the student could take the exam next week, and the parents, we really don't know them, and maybe they've done some shady things, or maybe the student has gotten in trouble before. Then I think it would be reasonable to say, look, sorry, no, you've got to wait until next week to take this exam. What's critical here isn't the ultimate decision. It's not like there's one obviously right choice here, just in the description that was given. It does depend on the context. It depends on the relevant facts. It depends on the principles. It depends on the, you know, is the school one where cheating is rampant, or is it a school where students can be trusted? That really matters. Basically, what we wish to do is make sure that the decision is based on the facts rather than on a kind of knee-jerk reaction of, well, that's the rule and to hell with you, or, you know, who cares about cheating kind of approach. Both of those would be wrong.
All right. So a lot to think about. What's the take-home point?
So I do think that rules, or rather the principles and goals of rules, really, really need to be respected by rulemakers and rule breakers, even though sometimes we might be breaking the rules or granting exceptions to them.
Wonderful. Okay, a little bit of follow-up action here. KPOM asks, is there a distinction between rules and the underlying principles? In other words, should you not violate principles? So for me, that's the goal. Principles
yeah,
need to be absolute.
I think if your principles are well formulated, they should not have exceptions, which means that principles are contextual. They apply in certain contexts and not in others, and you should know what those contexts are. And therefore, you should always be acting on the principle because you're only attempting to apply it in the relevant context. Rules, on the other hand, I do think that you can sometimes prioritize in certain ways. I mean, I think that rules are subject to constraints. I'm just sort of thinking about this. I'm thinking about the flossing example, right? Like they're subject to constraints or priorities in ways that principles are not.
Yeah. You can prioritize and weigh and balance the rules, but principles should be a capturing of a truth. So you don't really prioritize truths.
Yeah, it's not.
It doesn't work that way.
And so yesterday, actually, so I've been doing mindfulness meditation ever since AtlasCon, and so I'm on like day 27 or something like that. And yesterday was the first day I didn't do it. And like this is so my rule is I should meditate. It's one of my tasks. I've been doing it. I've been awesome. And then last night, I mean, I think I woke up this morning actually and was like, God damn it, I didn't meditate. But you know what? Like I didn't have time yesterday. Like that was my day. It was just not. You know, like, was I going to take 20 minutes out and not put that time into the show notes, which really needed more work, or you know, or what, right?
Like, high a priority.
There was a priority to the rule in a way that there isn't. So it's not like, well, honesty comes before justice. So, you know, therefore,
yeah.
I can be unjust to you, and but I'll tell you the truth. So I'm not. I think there's more to be said about this and what the role of rules and habits are in life and how they should interact with our principles. I think this is actually a really interesting question, and I don't have all the answers. Not yet. Maybe later.
Yeah. Okay. And he also asks, how does this interact with the concept of textualism versus contextualism when interpreting laws? In other words,
don't ask me this question.
Well, should SCOTUS have ruled as it did, setting aside whether Obamacare should exist?
I haven't looked at that decision. I don't actually know the difference between textualism and contextualism, and so I can't answer that at all.
Yeah.
I think there's differences between how we interpret text compared to how we, I mean, which are obviously there's relevant principles and rules and so on in the law. But I think that the law needs to be much more cut and dried than we need to be in our own daily lives. Like, it would be really bad if one day the law was like, today murder's not illegal. Tomorrow it will be. In the same way that I was like, forgot to meditate yesterday. Right? The law cannot do that. It needs to be much more strict. It needs to be much more so that people can plan and foresee and so on.
And that's one of the principles we have. We really want rule of law rather than rule of man. We don't want independent judgments to affect the activities of government officials. So I haven't read that either. So I don't know how blatant it was, but the idea I had was that if they really were blatantly reinterpreting what was really written and really had a purpose, like I think the people who were writing at the time may have even commented that we're doing this to incentivize people in that way, and now they're reading it another way because, well, they don't think it serves the purpose of the law. I don't think that's the right solution because it undermines the rule of law. Instead, they should have said, yep, you wrote that. Now go patch your law.
Right.
Because the Republicans were perfectly ready to go and patch the law.
Right. Right.
So bad solution.
Yeah.
Just at first blush.
So before we move on, Andrew's actually in the chat, so can I read what he actually says about quietly breaking the rules? If you're quietly breaking the rules, I would say that it should be quiet with respect to other people who might take an out-of-context example and break the rule willy-nilly. With respect to the rule makers or rule enforcers, that breakage should be very explicit and visible. That would discourage any temptation to get in the habit of hiding or sneaking around. So,
yes,
I would agree with that.
Yes.
I think that's a
good
way of framing that.
Yeah. All right. Enough of that. It's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
So Philosophy in Action Radio, not just a live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't accomplish that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please do contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. You can also create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and you get free access to Philosophy in Action's premium content. And we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Judgments of men versus women for sexual relationships with minors. Why aren't women strongly condemned for sexual relationships with underage boys? A few years ago, I saw a flurry of news stories about female teachers in their 20s committing statutory rape by having sex with their teenage male students. At the time, many public commentators and comedians said that they didn't see how the boys could have been harmed, and they thought an adult male teacher having sex with a female student would have been much more predatory. Besides, those commentators often added, the female teachers in these cases were hot. At the time, hot teacher. At the time, I agreed with those views. But lately, I've been thinking that I should check my premises. So is it the case that an adult man having sex with a female minor is more predatory than that of an adult woman having sex with a male minor? Are the teenage male minor's rights, grammatical problem there, violated if he is seduced into a sexual relationship with a female teacher? Is a double standard at work here?
Yeah, so there's definitely a double standard, and I've certainly seen the same phenomenon on my Facebook feed in terms of people rabidly condemning any kind of sexual relationship between an older man and an underage girl, but like, woohoo, hot for teacher.
Yeah, dream come true for that kid.
Yeah. Now, I think the question is whether this double standard is actually justified by facts about sexual differences between men and women, boys and girls, or, and this is what I'm going to propose, I think it's substantially based on faulty assumptions about the sexual natures of men versus women, and particularly about the sexual natures of sexually mature minors. So, and we are going to be talking about sexually mature minors, so we're not talking about 10-year-olds, right? We're talking about 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds. So I have talked before about my views on the law, basically whether statutory rape laws should exist and in what form. And so you can see my prior discussion of that, which was fairly lengthy. And in that discussion, I noted two major problems with the current way statutory rape laws work. First of all, there's no mens rea required. There's no requirement for a guilty mind. So a reasonable mistake on the part of the older person or deception on the part of the younger person doesn't exonerate somebody from the statutory rape clause statutory rape prosecution. The secondly is that the law treats the age gap itself as proof of a lack of consent, and that cannot be overridden even when there is evidence of obvious consent in the relationship. And I think that should be something that can be overridden. I mean, the law might say, look, we're gonna treat as a default if the, you know, let's say the age gap is more than 10, you know, if the younger person is 15 and under and the age gap is more than 5 or 10 years, we're going to treat that as prima facie evidence of lack of consent. But that could, in fact, be overridden. And particularly if the supposed victim goes to court and says, no, look, I wanted this, I pursued this, it was consensual, I think that should be taken seriously by the courts. Because I do think that 15-year-olds can consent to sex, including with people who are 25. So I think that's certainly possible. Now, I think the reason I review that is because I think there's a similar problem with our standard moral judgments. They're too crude. They're often just based on mere knowledge of the ages of the people and their sex. There's no concern, or there's people are making judgments without knowing anything about the nature of the relationship, whether it was manipulative or abusive, or whether it was genuinely consensual. People are just making these kind of snap judgments, and I think that's a problem because there's oftentimes details, and you don't know the inside of a relationship unless you at least know the people involved. You're making a very, very crude kind of judgment.
Okay, so let's break it down a little and let's focus on the age gap first. Then we can talk about roles and then maybe the sex of the parties involved.
Yes, because that's where the rubber's really going to hit the road. So first of all, I do want to be clear, we are not talking about an adult having a sexual relationship with a child. That's pedophilia. That's always and categorically wrong. So we're talking about an adult having a sexual relationship with a younger but still sexually mature minor. So somebody who is 15 and older, definitely that would count as sexually mature. 14 seems much more iffy to me, but again, that could depend on the individuals involved. So I do think it's reasonable, it's perfectly reasonable for people to have a kind of default assumption and a default judgment based on the size of the age gap between the persons involved, right, that it seems much, much more iffy for a 50-year-old to be having sex with a 16-year-old than for a 23-year-old to be having sex with a 16-year-old. Like, I think the bigger the age gap, the more iffy that relationship might seem, right? But it's important to recognize that these are assumptions. These are not definitive proof. It is perfectly possible for that relationship between the 50-year-old and the 16-year-old to be fully consensual. It could be something that the 16-year-old pursued really hard and that the 50-year-old really resisted for a while, right? And it might even be that that relationship is much more respectful and loving and kind and respectful and so on than that the younger person would find with somebody his or her own age. So,
yeah.
You know, again, you don't know what's going on in the middle of a relationship. You don't know how that works, at least unless you know the people involved.
Yeah, but it seems it's not imprudent to start with that as a default of like, whoa, okay, that could be bad.
Right.
Go look at the details now.
Right. Right.
Okay. How about the relevance of roles? In this case, the student-teacher relationship.
Yeah, I do think that's always a violation. It's always a moral violation on the part of the older person, meaning the teacher. because, well, A, in the obvious way, like sexual relations with your students is violating the letter and the spirit of your employment. And for good reason, right? You're potentially really threatening the reputation of your school. You're fostering a culture in which students can't trust teachers to be alone with them, et cetera, et cetera. And the same applies to coaching relationships too. But the problem is, the moral problem here is not merely procedural, right? There's a problem of implicitly, even if you're not trying to do it, using your position as the teacher or the coach, using that authority that you have in that role, mm-hmm. that can be used as leverage to pressure somebody into a sexual relationship, even if that's not what you want. And so I think in that case, again, it's reasonable to assume that the relationship is not consensual on the part of the younger person, but it is in fact manipulative and abusive. Again, it's not proof, but it's a strike against it, right? It's a reason for lots and lots of suspicion if the person is in an active coaching or teaching kind of relationship with the younger person.
This is what I've been hunting for, the right language for this. We have this language. These are red flags,
yes,
big red flags.
Yes.
Not a guarantee, but boy, they sure get your attention.
Yes.
Okay, now how about the sex of the people involved?
Yeah, so this is where things get really interesting. So I'm going to focus here on straight relationships. I think there's things that you can say about gay relationships, whether gay male or lesbian relationships. But I just think it's a bit clearer, and I'm already saying like way, way too much, so I'm trying to be a little bit limited. It's so nice. I'm so excited to be like, I've got to tell you all the things, people. So okay, here's my basic thesis. My basic thesis is that the radically different judgments that people have of relationships between adults and older minors based on the sex of the people involved is substantially about some really, really wrong views about male and female sexuality. So there's a tendency to regard men, younger or older, as predatory about sex. Like they want sex, they want lots and lots of sex, that's all they care about. They're not concerned about feelings, they're not concerned about respecting who they're with, they're just going to attempt to get what they want, even against resistance. And they should restrain themselves, they're bad, evil libidos, but some of them don't. And bad men, right? And so if there's an older man having a sexual relationship with a younger, a teenage girl, there's this assumption, if you have even slightly, even a bit implicitly, this view about men and sex, there's this assumption that he must have been the initiator, he must have been driving it, he must have been the driving force, and he must be exploiting her. But if you have an older woman, well, dude, that young man, he must just be thanking his lucky stars because, like, he wants sex, he's this way all the time, and he's found a woman who wants that too. Like, woohoo, right? Like,
score.
Yeah. Like, he couldn't possibly be exploited or vulnerable or pressured into that. In contrast to these brutish men, women are sexually passive. Women are pure. Women aren't really interested in sex. Women might be like they just want this emotional connection, and maybe sex is the price that they have to pay to get it. They're not out there pursuing sex. They are acquiescing to male desire. So if there's a younger woman in this relationship,
wow, how Victorian.
Yeah, I know. It's a kind of Madonna horror issue. If there's a younger woman, there's the assumption that she must have been exploited. She must have been pressured. She could not have wanted this. She could not have seduced the older man.
I did see that movie Lolita, messed up stuff.
Yeah, I haven't mm-hmm. I haven't seen that, but I was thinking of a Sting song, Don't Stand So Close to Me, like, which is about this, like it's about this issue, right? But if there's an older woman, again, like, boy, lucky you, you found one of the anomalies. Get while the getting's good, because there's not many women in the world who are going to be actually interested in sex. And so let me just say, and I have this in all caps in my notes, this is wrong, right? And it's particularly wrong about girls and women, right? There are many, many women out in the world, young and old, who want sex. They want lots and lots of sex. And they spend lots and lots of time planning and scheming to make that happen. Now, what I think happens is that particularly men don't seem to see this so clearly. And I think part of the reason is just because, particularly, let's say, in the teenage years, boys are spending time with other boys and girls are spending time with other girls. And so girls are talking about these things with each other, but they're not necessarily going to talk about that with their male friends. Another reason is also just what's visible here. Women tend to seduce. They are reeling the man in, and men tend to pursue. They're going for the woman in a much more visible way. And
in our culture, yeah.
Yeah, and I think some of that probably is rooted in biology, but it's a really, really overwhelming cultural norm. I mean, it's better than it used to be. And it used to be like you weren't allowed to call the boy ever, right? It used to be that like in the 50s, like there was this norm of the girl being completely passive in dating and in every other way.
When I was in school, it was a big deal to have these dances where the females asked the males.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, that stood out.
And I noticed that. I mean, the cultural norm is so strong. I noticed that, like, I'm a really assertive person, right? Like, I don't sit around and wait for stuff to happen. But this norm affects me, and I've really been thinking about all the ways in which I have this in my head in ways that need to actually change. So, you know, I'm not a wallflower, but so you could tell, like, if this affects me this strongly and I think about these kinds of things and I I'm out there getting what I want, that it's a big deal. It's really there in spades. Anyway, so, but there's this cultural norm, and as a result of this, though, whatever, like, however things should be, people see the pursuit. They see men pursuing women, but they're not as clued into women seducing the men, unless you're a woman. And then I think it's more apparent because you see what's going on.
But I gotta say, growing up, I was oblivious. I can look back and say, "Wow, they were practically hitting you over the head," and I'm completely oblivious.
Right.
Right. And nothing happened.
Right.
And they were probably just angry at me. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly, like, it's a problem. As a woman, like, you can feel like you have done the equivalent of, like, strip naked and said, "Would you please have sex with me?" And they don't know.
There are a couple of cases when I look back, it was about like that.
Right.
And they're like, "What are you, an idiot?" And I'm like, "Well, yeah, basically."
Yeah, yeah. So I think particularly to men, I think women see the seduction more clearly, but men don't always see that. And that's why I think oftentimes women have different judgments about these relationships than men do, that men tend to be the ones, at least in my experience, who are really the, "Oh, it's predatory, but hot," like if it's older man, younger woman, but "hot for teacher" if it's older woman, younger man. Anyway, so my basic point here is that sometimes the woman is really, really asking for it. And this can include young women, teenagers. She is really, really asking for it. She is in fact attempting to put the man in a difficult position. Right. So when you see a relationship between an adult man and a teenage girl, too many people, they do think that the man has made that happen. They think that she could not have done anything to invite his advances. She couldn't have initiated. She couldn't have seduced him. But she might well have done everything short of stripping herself naked and saying, "I want to have sex with you right now." She really might have. So it is interesting. Again, like, this is fairly obvious to me as somebody who is, like, grew up and is immersed in female sexual culture. But guys, you might need to check your premises, because it might be that those teenage girls that you thought were not interested in sex and would never have wanted to have a relationship with a high school teacher of yours, no, really, they were scheming as hard as they could.
Yikes.
Yeah.
Okay, so how should these relationships be judged?
So likely you don't have the context to judge from news reports whether a relationship was genuinely consensual or not. You can make assumptions, and they might be sort of good as stereotypical assumptions, but as applied to this particular case, they're probably pretty worthless. So just don't be that idiot posting to Facebook saying, "Well, this is obviously a creep dating on the poor innocent girl," or "Way to go, hot, you know, hot for teacher," right? Just don't be that person. Now, it's certainly possible. I mean, I don't want to discount the possibility of genuinely harmful, manipulative relationships, both on the part of older man, younger woman, and also on the part of older woman, younger man, because I think that a lot of the women, even women in their 20s, who are pursuing sex with their students, their 16-year-old, 17-year-old students, that's really uncalibrated. And I think that women probably see just how uncalibrated that is more than men do. And so it's possible that could be really harmful, that the way that relationship plays out could be really harmful. to the younger man, even if he really wants the sex and he's down with that. It can also be possible that a young woman can actually manipulate and control an older man, that she can particularly threaten him with exposure and do all kinds of things to get what she wanted. So you really don't know. In my own high school, so I went to a private all-girls school, and it was well known by everybody, apparently except for the administration, that there was a student, a girl who was a few years ahead of my class, who had an affair with one of the teachers. And again, like, everybody knew about this. And it was funny because we discussed it at a reunion a few years ago, the girls in my class, and we all knew she was not exploited. She was consensual. She was consenting. She knew what she wanted. She got exactly what she wanted to be in that relationship. Now, it was still wrong on his part, but it wasn't abusive. It wasn't manipulative. And I think we were able to say that because we knew the personalities of the people involved. And so other people might look at that from the outside and go, oh, he was predating on her. But no, he really wasn't. So my basic advice here is to ignore the media hyperventilating. Check your premises about female sexual desire. Don't make strong assumptions either way. And honestly, better yet, just ignore these stories unless they're actually relevant to your life, because what do they matter? And I guess that's actually my take-home point.
Yeah, I was going to say, that sounds like a take-home point.
Because I hadn't written a take-home point, but I do have that. So there we go. It's the take-home point.
Okay. All right. So Ezra asks, how does this issue relate to other age-related laws, such as driving, buying certain substances, and so forth?
I think that there is, in general, in the law, in an attempt to create a bright line, there is this ridiculous view by where somebody is completely incompetent until they turn 18, and then, ba-boom, like, they can do all the things. Or until they turn 16 or, 21 or whatever it is. And I think that's really ridiculous. I'm fine with having the legal age be a kind of default assumption, but it would be really nice if people would both morally and legally recognize that there's a gradation here and that there's differences between individuals and so on. So, yeah.
Okay. And he also asks, fully consensual, meaning devoid of force or devoid of deception and manipulation?
So I would say in the context of, particularly in the moral context, by what I mean by fully consensual means devoid of deception and manipulation and abuse, not just devoid of force. I'm not saying, like, I think there can be relationships, sexual relationships of it doesn't matter what age people are, that on the one hand, they're not rape, but they are deceptive and manipulative and abusive. And morally, those are really, really bad. And in a way, one person is not fully and freely consenting to them. Now, I think that legally speaking, it might be reasonable to say if one of those people is a minor, then that has legal implications, that might count as statutory rape in those kinds of cases. Because look, this person was a minor, and you didn't have this, just because you can hold them down, force yourself on them, doesn't mean that you had a relationship of equals. You know, you had no business having this kind of relationship with the person.
There's the parent who gets to make a lot of decisions for their minor, and the parent would probably have said no, and you. Now, the default is no.
Right. Sorry. Say that again, Greg. I'm not sure I agree with that.
As with a lot of decisions regarding minors, the parent gets to decide, should my child have, say, a drink of wine with dinner or whatever.
Right.
In this case, should my child be having sex with you, the parent would say no, and even if the child is saying yes.
Right. Now, I do think I don't think that parents can simply forbid their children from having sex. They're
no
sexually mature children, and we talked about this actually in the statutory rape case. Like, I actually think that you should be able to take out a restraining order, and at that point, after that, it would be statutory rape. I think that there's I don't think that parents can give just a total no sex until you're out of my house. So Andrew asks, and this is a follow-up on this fully consensual question, which is why I want to read it here. He says, doesn't the law need to account for the fact that in general minors are not as mentally mature as adults and may consent or even manipulate the adult? but the obligation is still on the part of the adult to make the mature decision. And yes, I would agree with that, and in part that's why I'm using this language of kind of fully consensual, meaning devoid of deception and manipulation and abuse. But I also think that adults can make wrong decisions that are not criminal. Like the adult could do the wrong thing, but in a way that wouldn't make it statutory rape, or would make it like, wow, that was imprudent or that was a bad decision, but it wasn't the same as being manipulative and abusive to a teenage girl or teenage
girl. Michael says, isn't it interesting that the courts believe it proper to determine whether or not a person is to be considered a minor or adult for murder, but not for sex? They believe one could be aware of his or her actions when it comes to shooting up a school, but not for having sex with a teacher at that school.
Yes, I would agree with that. This is part of our weird American views about sex. And this is particularly true for young women. Right. I think that the courts, I don't know legally what the courts would do, but I'm pretty sure that most people would say, well, yeah, he's 16. He was acting as an adult, but about a young man, but about a young woman. No. And like, dude, you need to spend some time with young women because they have agendas and they have sexual agendas.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't you remind listeners about your book, Responsibility and Luck?
So my first book, Responsibility and Luck, A Defense of Praise and Blame, is available for purchase in paperback and Kindle formats. The book defends the justice of moral praise and blame for persons using an Aristotelian theory of moral responsibility, thereby refuting Thomas Nagel's problem of moral luck. It's an academic work, but it is accessible to anyone with an interest in philosophy. And so for details, including free preview chapters, you can go visit philosophyinaction.com/moral luck. And you can find more premium content over at philosophyinaction.com/premium.
Yeah. Quick question here on the procedure. Do you want to do number three or just move on?
Let's just do some rapid fire. I feel like I have fire hosed y'all enough already, and I'll save number three for another time.
Okay. Then it's rapid fire question time. We'll put Diana on the hot seat asking questions from this long and growing queue in any old order without nearly as much planning, and we'll see what happens. Let's see. Huh. Apropos, is strength a virtue or a moral amplifier?
Well, it's obviously a moral amplifier.
Yeah.
Obviously a moral.
You can do horrible things with your big strength, or you could do great things with your big strength.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Another procedural thing. Given that you take requests for questions to answer, how much does voting on the questions really matter?
So it does matter to me. So when I pick questions for upcoming that are in the queue. So there's a bunch of questions that have really high numbers of votes. Let me start at the beginning. So if somebody makes a request, somebody who's a regular contributor who has basically bribed me to answer a question sooner, I will move things around to put that question as soon as I reasonably can. So those get top priority. But then I have that, that doesn't happen, sometimes that'll happen, every week for a few weeks, but oftentimes that doesn't happen for a month or two. So people don't, I'm not inundated with requests to answer questions. So then I have to make decisions about what I'm picking from the queue. And on the one hand, there are a bunch of questions that have been in the queue for a long time that have really high votes, mostly because they've been in the queue for a long time. And I'm like, oh, I just don't want to answer those. So I don't care how many votes they have. I'm not going to answer them until I feel like it. Then there's basically there's what I'm looking for in particular. Well, A, I'm looking for two things after that. I'm looking for questions that are interesting to me that I know I have something to say about and that I get excited about. And often those are ones that are more newly submitted. And then I'm looking for questions that are rising quickly in the vote. So I'll look at them sorted by date. And I'll see which ones, this has 4 votes, this has 6 votes, this has 8 votes. And then there's one that'll have like 23 votes. And then 4 votes, 6 votes, 8 votes. Right? That's the one I'm like, okay, people are clearly interested in this. I'm gonna go ahead and pick this one and answer this one sooner. So that's how that that's how that tends to work. That's how I tend to make decisions. Now, I have plans in the works to write my own Q software, which I will one of these days, so that I can track those better and do more interesting things with the Q, because right now the Q sort of sucks. The Q software sucks. So, you know, I'm limited in terms of what I can do with that. But so yes, voting actually does matter. And if you want something answered sooner, but you don't want to pay me a bit of money to make that happen, post on Facebook and get your friends to upvote it.
There you go. All right. Finally, my coworker makes unfunny, snide comments to me under the guise of kidding around. When I defend myself with cutting responses, he acts taken aback and accuses me of being sensitive. What should I do?
I misread this question when I posted it, because I thought it was that I make unfunny, snide comments to my coworker under the guise of kidding around, and then I defend myself with cutting responses. So that seemed like, okay, that's completely indefensible. But this is different. I think that when people do that, when people use humor as a weapon in that way, like they use they're pretending to be funny, and they're not. They're actually being hurtful. The best response is not to respond in kind. I think the best response is to say something like, "Wow, that really hurt." And walk away.
Yeah, that came off as mean. Oh, don't be so sensitive.
Yeah.
Like, well, don't say things like that. It comes off
right.
as mean.
Right. So don't defend yourself with cutting responses. Be actually, I think it's a little bit hard, but show your vulnerability. Show that hurt. And that way, the coworker, it might take him a while to learn, but other people around you will notice, and they might, like if you walk away, they might say to that guy, "Dude, that was not cool," and that might actually make a difference. These people who use humor in this false way to attack other people, not cool. Like really, really not cool.
Yeah, call them out on it.
It's very dishonest. It's very manipulative. It's very underhanded. And particularly when you do call them out on it, they say like, "Oh, you just can't take a joke," or you know, "You're just like you like humor," or whatever. Like, dude, that's really bad. So A, don't be that person, and B, I think try to deal with that. Like, be willing to be hurt. I think it's hard, but be willing to.
Or make it clear that they're being hurtful. Michael comments cowardly. Yep.
Yep.
After you've pointed it out a few times, you can start pointing out, hey, you know, if someone says they just made a mistake, and the mistakes always lean one direction, kind of makes it so it doesn't look like a mistake.
Right.
So now it's on you to be more responsible.
Right. Right.
Yeah. People. All right. Here, one last one. Boy, we got a lot in the queue there. Okay, it's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. Once again, thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we do depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just email it to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
And if you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, go visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Brickle, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.